From our studios in Cuenca, Spain, I'm Kate Jetmore with Listen, the podcast that highlights the common threads that run through different cultures and unite us as human beings. Today, we kick off Season 7, a series of interviews about religion and spirituality. I myself was raised in a loving Catholic home, and while I do not currently practice a formal religion, I'm fed by the questions and the search inspired by the religions of the world. The guests who will join us for this series come from a variety of backgrounds, and each has a unique story to tell. My guest today is Sarah Ronan, a 49-year-old American who has raised four children while completing two university degrees. She has a master's in education. She has used this degree to travel the world and teach abroad. She is currently an elementary librarian at the largest Islamic school in the South, in the suburbs of Dallas, Texas. Welcome, Sarah. I'm so glad you could join us today.
Hi, Kate. How are you? I'm glad I can join today, too.
Yeah, it's wonderful to see you and hear you. I'm really excited about our conversation, given the fact that we grew up together. We met when we were about 12 years old, I think. We went to junior high, we went to high school, and then, you know, I think this is a common story these days, but we hooked up a few years ago on Facebook. So big pause there. If you don't mind, I'd like to start at the beginning. I'd love it if you could tell us a little about where you grew up and how you were raised.
Okay, well, I was raised in a relatively small town in Indiana. At the time we were living there, I remember in high school geography, they told us that we had 40,000 people in our town at that time. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't super small, but it wasn't large by any stretch of the imagination. So that's where I grew up. And I was an unlikely candidate to accept Islam, being there in the Midwest of small town Indiana. I was raised in a very strict evangelical family. I fell away from Christianity in my upper teens due to some strained family relations and questioning some doctrine. And then I didn't practice any religion at all until I was about 28 years old.
And what was that like? I mean, if you were raised in a strict, you know, if the religious practice in your home growing up was fairly strict and structured, when you got away from it, was that a relief to you? Did you like it? Or did you find yourself yearning for something that would provide some kind of structure? So, you know, that kind of thing that felt familiar to you.
Well, I fell away from the religion at about the age of 17. And so for the first 7 or 8 years, it was a relief because I had been raised in such a strict environment, and we went to church like 3 or 4 times a week. Went to church camp every summer, and I taught at church camp and went to Bible school every summer, and wow. I taught at Bible school and went to choir practice, and we were at the church, I used to say, every time the doors were open. So at first it was a relief. For the first several years, I didn't practice any religion at all, just kind of did my own thing, had fun, fell into a little bit of trouble here and there, mm-hmm. But just did my own thing. But then when I hit about 28 years old, I started searching for a deeper meaning in life. It just seemed to me all of a sudden that there's got to be something more than what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what it was, but I thought, there's got to be something more to life than just the fun and partying that I'm doing. Mm-hmm. So I started visiting different denominations of Christian churches, mm-hmm. because I thought maybe the problem that I was having was just with my specific denomination. Mm-hmm. So I started investigating different denominations and hoping that I would find what I was looking for, which was a personal relationship with God. Mm-hmm. So I visited all these different denominations, and I failed finding what I was looking for.
And what did that look like, Sarah? I mean, did you literally, you know, once a week go to a different church?
Yes, I went to I remember one time I was in a sandwich shop, and I saw these two men praying before they ate their lunch, and I even went over to them and said, "What church do you go to?" Mm-hmm. Because I want to visit it. So I visited these different denominations on different Sundays and Wednesdays, and mm-hmm. and I just didn't find what I was looking for. I still had a void, mm-hmm. a void in my life. So finally, I just decided to follow my own brand of spirituality. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to have a code of ethics, and I'm going to, I bought a new Bible, and I thought, I will read my Bible, mm-hmm. and I will follow some rules, you know, some self-imposed rules, but mm-hmm. I'm not going to follow any specific brand of Christianity. Mm-hmm. So I did that starting at the age of 28, and then I moved to a fairly big city at that time and started encountering people of all different races and backgrounds and faiths at work. Mm-hmm. So I started doing an academic research at this point. Mm-hmm. I started looking into different religions just to see what they believed, just so that I wouldn't do anything offensive to the people I encountered at work, because I didn't know anything other than Christianity. Mm-hmm. In our small town in Indiana, there wasn't really anything but Christianity. Right. So I hadn't been introduced to anything else. So when I moved to this bigger city, I started looking into Hinduism and Buddhism and Judaism and Sikhism, and that was just getting, when I was just getting ready to start looking into Islam, I met the man who was going to become my husband.
Uh-huh. And I think he was Muslim, isn't that right?
He was Muslim, that's correct.
Wow. So, wow, that seems like a coincidence. Do you think it was a coincidence?
Well, at that time, I thought it was a coincidence. Now, 20 years down the road, as a practicing Muslim, I believe that God sent him to me at the right time, at the right place, mm. when I was open to hearing a little bit about it, because had he been sent to me 2 years prior, I wouldn't have even listened to anything that he had to say.
Right.
So yeah, he was Egyptian and he was Muslim. Mm-hmm. He didn't practice very strongly. He was kind of like me with my Christianity. He had a definite code of morals and a definite, you know, he didn't drink alcohol, he didn't eat pork, you know, the big things in Islam. Islamic religion, mm-hmm. but he wasn't, you know, a real strong practicing Muslim. Mm-hmm. However, he introduced me.
So was
me
it
to
sort of more of a cultural thing for him? You know, he
yes.
had been born into that?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
He was
okay.
born and raised as a Muslim, and he was a proud Muslim. He would mm-hmm. tell anybody who wanted to know that he was Muslim. Mm-hmm. He wasn't ashamed of it, but he didn't do all of maybe the daily rituals mm-hmm. that a practicing Muslim would do.
Okay.
So
so tell us a little bit about that. What was it like, you know, meeting him and stepping into his culture, his language? I think he was Egyptian.
Yeah, he was Egyptian, and he spoke mainly Arabic at work because he owned his own business and he employed other Egyptians and other Arab-speaking men at work. Mm-hmm. And all of his friends were other Egyptians and other Arabs. So really, the only one he spoke English to was myself. So it could get frustrating. You know, he mm-hmm. would, there's no such thing as eavesdropping on phone calls, because he would would be on the phone and he would be speaking in Arabic and I wouldn't know what they were talking about. Mm-hmm. So that was a little frustrating. Mm-hmm. But he had a sister that lived in town, the same town. Mm-hmm. And so he did kind of follow that, you know, unmarried people shouldn't be left alone by themselves. Mm-hmm. So we would go sit at his sister's house after work, and she didn't speak hardly any English. So it was always interesting. But her husband spoke English, and so her husband and then my soon-to-be husband and myself would sit and speak in English and get to know each other a little
bit. Did you ever make any attempts to learn Arabic?
I did. I have been Muslim now for 20 years, mm-hmm. going fast forwarding, mm-hmm. and I've spent time in the Middle East, and I guess I haven't done a real concentrated effort. I've never taken any courses mm-hmm. or anything, but I've picked up a bit of the Egyptian dialect here and there, mm-hmm. and I say I can speak like a toddler. I can tell you I'm hungry, I'm thirsty, I need a towel, I need to go to the bathroom, I need to go to bed, where's the bank, where's the hospital, but I can't hold a conversation. Okay. So I guess I haven't tried as hard as I could have. I know a lot of other people that are married to Arab men mm-hmm. who speak Arabic pretty fluently. Mm-hmm. And I always say language isn't my strong suit. I took Spanish in mm-hmm. high school for 4 years, and now I don't remember hardly any of it. Uh-huh. So language.
Yeah, I'm in a bicultural marriage, and my husband and I almost always speak in Spanish. And I think it comes down to like, what language did you speak to each other when you first met? And also, whose language skills are stronger? You know what I mean?
Yes, and we always spoke in English. He didn't try to speak to me in Arabic. Mm-hmm. We always spoke in English, and it was just easy for me. And then his family in Egypt, the majority of them had perfect English. His mm-hmm. family in Cairo even speak unaccented English.
Wow.
Their English is perfect. His family in Alexandria, his mom's side, they speak English, but it is accented, but it's they speak British English.
Okay.
And so it mm-hmm. was very easy for me to go over there and not have to speak Arabic. If I wanted to go shopping, I would just bring one of the kids with me and they'd translate for me.
Yeah.
And so it was very easy for me not to. Yeah. It was easy for me to be lazy. Yeah.
Well, Sarah, coming back to your process, you know, you said you were about ready to look into Islam when you met your husband. What happened to that, you know, your search, your journey? I mean, what did that look like as you continued to look into Islam?
Well, I was getting ready to start. I had just got done looking into Judaism, mm-hmm. had just bought some books on Islam, and that's when my soon-to-be husband came into my life. Mm-hmm. And even though he wasn't really practicing, he introduced me to friends of his who did practice. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, no mm-hmm. one talked to me about Islam. It was the strangest thing. Mm-hmm. You know, you hear all these things in the news media about Muslims are trying to take over the world and trying mm-hmm. to make people convert by the sword mm-hmm. and forcing people to convert. But the people my husband brought me around were devout Muslims, but they never talked to me about Islam. Mm-hmm. But what they did do is they live by example.
Okay.
And I took note of this. My husband had two friends in particular that made an impression on me. Mm-hmm. They lived with such peace and kindness and simpleness and dignity. Mm-hmm. And I wanted what they had. They spoke kindly. They never seemed stressed. They never said a bad word about anybody. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted what they had. So I started reading about Islam, and what I was going to do, it's the funniest thing looking back now, what I was going to do is I was going to research Islam and find this one thing that gave them that peace and tranquility and simplicity of life and the nice lifestyle. And I was going to cherry pick that one thing out of Islam. And I was going to take that and I was going to apply that to my life and leave the rest of Islam behind. So I wasn't interested in becoming Muslim, but I was interested in having the peace and the tranquility and the lifestyle that these two gentlemen had. So I was going to extract that one part.
And I'm going to guess that didn't work out for you.
That's not how religion works, as many of us know now.
Well, Sarah, are there any moments that really stand out for you during this process? Any light bulb moments or discoveries you made that made it clear to you you were on the right path?
Well, I went ahead. I married this Egyptian man 10 months after we met.
Oh, wow.
He was Muslim and I was still, I called myself Christian, even though I wasn't really practicing any Christianity. But we went ahead and got married. And after we got married, I started reading more about Islam, still trying to find that one thing. And I was reading more and more about Islam, and the more I read, the more I was finding that everything I was looking for in Christianity, and when I was hopping from church to church to church trying to find the, you know, what I was looking for in Christianity, I started finding that everything I had been looking for in Christianity, I was finding in Islam. And then one night, I had a dream that this beautiful man came to me, and he was wearing a long white robe, and he was speaking to me in Arabic. And I didn't understand the dream, and I didn't understand Arabic. So in the morning, I told my husband about the dream, and he said that it was the Prophet Muhammad who had come to me in the dream. And he said that this makes me a very special, like, chosen one, and most people will never experience the Prophet coming to them at any time. And so it really made an impression on me that, you know, I'm somebody special. You know, the Prophet came to me in a dream and he chose me to come to. So that made a huge impression on me.
I'll bet. Can you still see the dream in your mind's eye?
I do still see it. It was very real. It was a beautiful dream. He was a beautiful man, and everything about it was like soft and flowing, and it made a huge impression on me at that time.
Wow. I'm very curious to ask you this next question. I know you wear the hijab, and I would really like to know what that feels like. You know, in our Western society, it's no secret that some people say, that Muslim women are oppressed, that they are obliged to cover their heads. What is your story? How did you make the decision to wear the hijab, and what does that feel like?
Well, this is another strange story. I mean, I don't want the listeners to think I'm crazy, but something else happened to me shortly after the dream. I was still reading about Islam. I'd had the dream, and a few weeks later, I was at work. I got married in July, so this was all from July to October. I had the dream, and then one day I was at work. I was a hairstylist, a cosmetologist, and I was wearing, you know, capri pants and a short sleeve shirt, nothing too risque, you know, just regular summertime clothing for hairstylists. But then suddenly I felt like a light was shining down on me, and I was naked. It was the most surreal feeling, but I really felt like a light was shining down on me. And so I went home that day. I put on full-length pants and a long-sleeve shirt and a headscarf that just happened. There happened to be a couple headscarves at our home. And on that day, I went out and I bought new clothes. And I have worn the hijab ever since that day. And that was 6 weeks before I did the testimony of faith and became a Muslim. So I'm different than most Muslim women. I actually started wearing the hijab before I ever even became Muslim.
Wow. So it sounds very visceral, just a decision that was very organic.
Yes. I was not forced to. My husband actually, as we said, he didn't practice real strongly. He actually didn't like the hijab, didn't want me to wear it. He did get used to it over the years and got to the point that he was buying hijabs for me. But in the beginning, he was against it, but he said, you know, if you believe it, then I'm not going to stop you from doing it. Right. So it's different than what, you know, people tend to think, as you said, that Muslim women are oppressed, that it's their husbands that make them wear the hijab, their father that makes them wear the hijab. And while that might be the case in some countries that are practicing man's law and not Islam's rules, my husband did not force me to wear the hijab. Nobody in my life forced me to wear the hijab. It was a decision that I took 100% on my own.
Well, thank you, Sarah, for sharing that with us. We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back to hear all about Sarah's new life after making her declaration of faith. Back in a second.
Listen is sponsored by RAF, cutting-edge cuisine in a traditional setting. For a look at the RAF dining experience, visit www.rafsanpedro.es. That's www.rafsanpedro.es.
This is Kate Jetmore with Listen. If you're just joining us, my guest is Sarah Ronan, who's talking about the role played by Islam in her spiritual journey. Sarah, before the break, we were talking about what it's like to cover your head and wear the hijab, but I wonder if you could talk more broadly about what it's like for a woman in the Muslim world.
Well, when I first started investigating Islam, after I had met my soon-to-be husband, and when I first started looking into it, I said very strongly that I was not going to become one of those oppressed women with a scarf on her head. And then that I had the dream, and that I had the bright light shining down, and I started wearing hijab. But even after I started wearing hijab, I had I brought two children into the marriage, and my husband brought two children into the marriage, and we had full custody of all of them. So when we got married, they were 9, 10, 11, and 12. So,
My gosh.
Yes. Yes. And so I had two young girls at home. They were 10 and 11. My daughter and his daughter, they were 8 months apart in age. Well, they still are 8 months apart in age. And I wanted to be very clear and set a clear example to them that just because I had started wearing the headscarf did not mean life had ended for me. So I made sure that I took them places, and we went canoeing, and we went rock wall climbing, and we went horseback riding, and we went to concerts. I took them to Destiny's Child, was a big thing back then. I took them to see Destiny's Child with Beyonce, and I just made sure, you know, we went to Egypt and I rode a camel around the pyramids and I took a sailboat ride with them. And I just wanted to make it very clear to them that just because you start wearing the headscarf doesn't mean that you're banished to the house for the rest of your life and you are going to be cooking and cleaning for the rest of your life and the fun ends. So I made a very conscious effort to make it clear to them, and I got involved with some youth at the mosque that that life still goes on and you still have fun even when you wear hijab, and that you're not oppressed and you can do just about anything. You know, I went swimming. I got what they call the burkini. We don't call it the burkini, but the non-Muslim community calls it the burkini. I got one of those and I went swimming and I swam in the Mediterranean Sea, and you know, I went swimming at the pool, and just show them that I can still do everything that everybody else does.
That is really interesting to have that peek into what, you know, what was going through your head as a mom and as a stepmom. What were some of the parts of your life that changed after you converted? I'm sure before you converted, I'm sure you had an idea of what that would be like. Was it what you expected?
Well, when I originally converted, I was a cosmetologist. I had been doing hair for about 10 years. And then shortly after accepting Islam, I felt that this wasn't really the job for me anymore. I wasn't really comfortable, like, for instance, cutting men's hair, you know. In Islam, we're not supposed to touch the opposite gender and so forth. So when people decide to get their hair cut by somebody, they often look at that person and see what their hair looks like and get an idea of what, you know, if that person's good at their job or not. So they would look at me and they couldn't see my hair, so they were leery of me. And the funny thing is, I always say, if you like your hairdresser's hair, go to the person next to them because they're the one cutting it, you know, because we don't cut our own hair. So,
exactly. So
I had a girlfriend at work that always cut my hair and I always cut her hair. So I'm like, if you like Monica's hair, then come see me because I'm the one that cut and colors her hair. But people don't understand that. So anyway, I just wasn't real comfortable in the cosmetology field anymore. So I went back to the university when my kids were in high school. And I got my BA in interdisciplinary studies, nonprofit management. And at that point, I began working in Islamic organizations. I worked in a political wing of a Muslim Dawah movement, which is Dawah is calling people to Islam. And I worked at an Islamic center for a while. So I did all my nonprofit work in the Islamic field. But then I still wasn't completely satisfied. I still felt like I needed to do more. And that's when I decided to go back and get my master's in education. And I have been teaching school for 7 years now. I did my master's when my kids were in college. So we all kind of did school together. And I've worked as a teacher now for 7 years, and all seven of those years have been in Islamic schools. And I've also been blessed with the opportunities to teach overseas in both Saudi Arabia and Malaysia. And if I hadn't been Muslim, I don't think these opportunities and connections would have come to me. That, you know, because the thing about the Malaysia job is a lady that I knew, an American that I knew that lived in Egypt, contacted me and said, you know, do you have a master's degree? And I said, yeah. And she was like, and you're obviously Muslim. I said, yes. And she said, you're obviously fluent in English. And I said, yes. And she said, well, I have a friend that's looking to fill a position in Malaysia. And she's like, can I put you in contact with this lady in Malaysia? So it was a friend of in Egypt that got me the connection to the job in Malaysia. Had I not been Muslim, you know, these opportunities wouldn't have come to me. And living in Malaysia was one of the best things that have ever happened to me. I loved it there. Beautiful country. So,
well, and it's interesting, Sarah, because, you know, back in the first part of our conversation, when you were talking about, you know, your search first in Christianity and then beyond Christianity and then kind of, you know, focusing more on Islam, it sort of sounded to me, and I didn't say it out loud as you were talking, but it sounded to me like you were looking for a community. And it sounds like that's what you found. You know, you found this wonderful network of people who look out for each other.
I think that's a fair statement. I didn't know it at the time, but I think I was looking for that community, that family, that that network. And I have found that in Islam. I mean, ever since I've been Islam, my career is even about Islam. Ever since I've been Muslim for 20 years, and I've been working in some type of Islamic organization for almost that whole 20 years. So my whole life is Islam. My personal life, my professional life, is all.
Well, and you took us through, I mean, it's obvious that your religion has had a huge influence on your professional life from everything you've told us. Tell us a little bit more about how it has affected your personal life.
Well, my husband and I would spend most every summer in Egypt, which, as we said earlier, is his home country. He spent his first 30 years of life in Egypt, so he was very Egyptian. He didn't move here at a young age like many do, so he was very Egyptian. And these summers in Egypt began my love affair with Egypt and Mediterranean food and the Egyptian people. And as I said before, many life opportunities and travel opportunities have come to me through Islam and Muslims.
I mean, I can hear you. It's clear from what you're saying, and it just sounds really rich. I know you lost your husband several years ago. How long ago did you lose him?
It's almost, it'll be 4 years in September, so a little over 3.5 years.
Have you continued to follow the traditions that he brought into your marriage? Do you still cook Egyptian food, for example, or have you sort of returned to your roots now that you're on your own?
It's been a struggle. The first couple years was a real struggle of identity, because I was very much immersed in the Egyptian world for 16 years of marriage, and then suddenly that was gone. I mean, I still had my friends, and I still had his family, but, you know, he wasn't there anymore. And so I had a struggle. I had like a cultural struggle within myself, and I wasn't sure where I fit in anymore. But I think just this last year, I finally balanced it out that I'm just like I was before. I'm still an American girl, a Midwest girl that is very heavily influenced by Egyptian and Arabic culture. So now, the first couple years, I didn't cook any Arabic food, Egyptian food, Mediterranean food, whatever you want to call it, because it reminded me of him, and it was hard. But just this last year, during my work week, and I did this when I was married, during my work week, I cook American food, because American food is very quick to cook. A lot of it you can throw all in one one dish and pop it in the oven or the crock pot, and it's done in a couple hours. But on the weekends, and while we've been in this shelter in place quarantine throughout the world, I've been cooking a lot of Egyptian food. It's reminded me of how much I loved it, because it just takes more time to cook Egyptian food. A lot more love goes into cooking Egyptian food. A lot of stirring, a lot of pots and pans, a lot of steps. But the food is delicious, and I was just getting ready. It's funny. I was just getting ready to say it reminds me of home, which my home is now the home that I had with my husband. When I think of home, I don't think of Midwest Indiana anymore. I think of that cultural conglomeration that I had for 16 years.
Yeah, I can imagine that. And it's, you know, the concept of home evolves as your life goes on. I mean, it's at first it's the home that you remember that your parents made for you, and then it sort of becomes the home that you made for your kids along with your husband. You know, I take the same way that you guys spent your summers in Egypt. I take our son back to Indiana every summer. And, you know, I do that because I want him to experience American life, and I want him to know my family, and I want him to feel comfortable with American culture. And he does, believe me. And I miss Indiana. I want to be there as well. But, and I'm just saying this based on what you just said, I always take my own olive oil with me. I always take Mediterranean olive oil with me back to Indiana so that I can cook certain dishes. And it doesn't cost a fortune, because in Indiana you can buy olive oil, but it's so expensive and it's not, the quality is not as good. I'm sure that's something that your husband talked about when it comes to Mediterranean olive oil. Sarah, we're going to take another short break and we'll be right back to continue our conversation. It's such a pleasure to share our interviews with you each week, and your feedback means the world to us. Let us know which episodes you're enjoying most and what you hope to hear in the future. I'm also hoping you'll subscribe to our podcast. When you rate and review your favorite episodes, it helps widen our audience and bring more people into the fold. You can find us on social media and check out the new Listen blog on our website at thelistenpodcast.com. We're talking today with Sarah Ronan about her spiritual journey and becoming a practicing Muslim nearly 20 years ago. Sarah, it sounds like your search for a religion that was a good fit for you began a long time before you met your husband. But it's also true that your conversion really coincided with meeting him and falling in love. So I'm interested to know, ultimately, do you feel like you converted for reasons that had to do with him, or did you do it for yourself?
I definitely feel like I did it for myself. I mean, Allah, God, put him in my path at the exact right time when I was ready to hear and receive the message. But it definitely wasn't because of him. As I said earlier, my husband was happy with me the way I was. And if I would have stayed Christian through the whole marriage, he wouldn't have had a problem with that. He just loved me for me. And but when I became Muslim, of course, that made him happy. Well, it's funny because I actually asked him, you know, are you happy I became Muslim? And he said, I remember his exact words to this day. It was 20 years ago. And he said, yes, I'm happy because now you can go to heaven. you know, because mm-hmm. in his mindset, you know, Muslims are going to heaven. I have a broader view. I believe the Quran says that there are people of the book, which would be Christians and Jews, that are also mm-hmm. going to go to heaven. So I believe that heaven's not a small place that only one mm-hmm. person or one group is going to. So I think we all find our path to God, and mm-hmm. and Islam happens to be my path to God and the path that has worked for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You talked before, Sarah, about wearing a headscarf and what that feels like, and you know where how you came to that decision. Could you share with us what it feels like to be a Muslim in America? Do you feel safe? Do you feel heard? What does that feel like?
Most of the time, I feel safe. I live in a big city in Texas now, and a lot of people, when they think of Texas, they think of cowboy boots and cowboy hats and cowboys. That is not what Texas is like, or not the area of Texas I'm in anyway, in North Texas. There are tons of Muslims in North Texas. So everywhere I go, and I work at an Islamic school, so my workplace is all Muslims. And when I go to the grocery store, my checkout clerk is wearing a hijab. And I see several other women wearing hijabs when I am out shopping. And so I feel very safe and accepted here. When I go back home to Indiana, I do feel like sometimes I get some strange looks. I call it the "oh my God" look, because
what does that mean? That you feel like people feel scared when they see you?
I don't think so much scared, but they're just caught off guard. Many of them may not have seen a woman with a headscarf before. Many of them are not sure. Some may not know what it represents. They just have a look of shock on their face. That's why I call it the "oh my God" look, because they have a look of shock on their face. So I get that a lot. When my late husband and I were married, we lived in Ohio, and a big city in Ohio, and it wasn't too much different from Indiana. There were a lot more Muslims there, but the area that we lived in, a lot of Muslim women did not wear the headscarf, so it was still sort of rare to see a woman in a headscarf. You certainly didn't have them checking you out at the grocery, and if you did see another woman in a headscarf at the grocery store, you got excited, you know, that there was another Muslim. So I think
I wanted to ask you where you were on September 11th. Had you already converted? Where were you living? What can you share about your experiences on that day? And, you know, was it a watershed moment? Was it a before and after for you?
Yes, I had converted in November of 2000. So I had been Muslim about 10 months when September 11th happened. Oddly enough, we had just gotten home from Egypt about a week before that. So we had been in Egypt. That was my first summer in Egypt. And we had gotten home about a week before September 11th and got the kids in school. And I remember I wasn't back to work yet from our trip from Egypt. So I had gotten up and I was going to watch Montel Williams, I think, the talk show host.
Yes.
I got up and I was going to watch him on the TV. And I flipped on the TV and the first plane had already hit. So the news was on, and it was showing, you know, the live newscast of the smoke from the first tower. And I was watching that when the second plane hit.
So you watched it live.
Yeah, I was watching it live. I didn't see the first plane, but I saw the second plane hit. And when the second plane hit, I, like every other American, I guess, thought, this is on purpose. The first plane, you were like, it was an accident, it was a freak accident, right. You know. But then when the second plane hit, you thought, you know, we're under attack from someone. And I remember my husband came home from work, and we were watching it on the TV. And then my kids, when they came home from school, we were all watching it. And we had the TV on all night that first night, hoping that they were going to find survivors. And we slept with the television on. And I remember at some point in the evening, I said to my husband, you know, my goodness, please don't let them say that this was the Muslims. And and I don't even know what made me say that. And then it was in very short order after the planes hit that they started saying that they, you know, thought it was Islamic terrorism. And the next day, I was supposed to return to work, and my work called me and told me not to come because they didn't feel like it was safe for me there. And my husband told me to take off the headscarf because he didn't feel like it was safe for me. I kept my headscarf on, but I didn't go out for a few days. And when I did go out, I was apprehensive and scared. In the months following, I did have some people like yell stuff at me from the car, raghead, towelhead, go home, that type of thing. But it was never, I never felt really threatened.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. And I thank you for sharing your memories with us and, you know, looking back a little bit at the past. What about the future? What do you see for yourself when you look toward the future? Do you have an idea of where your path will lead you?
Well, we've talked a lot about my husband and my path to Islam. And as we said, he passed away nearly 4 years ago. And about 7 months ago, I met a new man. He is a Muslim man. And he may just become my husband. Nothing's set in stone yet, but we're working towards that direction. And you know what else about him? He is Egyptian. So my love affair with Islam and Egypt may just continue. I wasn't looking for an Egyptian. I wasn't looking for him, but we were introduced through friends of friends who thought we would be a good match, and so far those friends were right.
Wow. Well, that is wonderful news. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And it's a wonderful note to wrap up our conversation on. Sarah, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us on the podcast today. It's been great catching up with you and hearing about your story. And I want to wish you and your family all the best.
Thank you. I've enjoyed speaking with you today.
Thank you, Sarah. Next time on Listen, we'll be joined by Arun Deva, an Ayurvedic practitioner and yoga therapist. Hope you can join us. The Listen podcast is produced and recorded in Cuenca, Spain, where the Gothic Cathedral features twin Baroque organs, both restored and in working order. Check out our archives at thelistenpodcast.com. There are 6 full seasons waiting for you there, all free and easy to access. Lauren Lovett is our producer. Caitlin Fisher handles our social media. And Lidia Munoz Solera writes our blog. Editing, tech support, and original music are courtesy of Lucas Munoz Jetmore. I'm Kate Jetmore, and this is Listen.